Section 22 of Notes on Democracy by H. L. Mencken. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Part 3, Chapter 4, Corruption Under Democracy. This moral compulsion of the Puritan and Democrat, of course, is mainly bogus. When one has written off cruelty, envy, and cowardice, one has accounted for 9/10 of it. Certainly I need not argue at this late date that the Puritan of New England was by no means the vestal that his heirs and assigns think of when they praise him. He was not only a very carnal fellow, and given to lamentable transactions with loose women in fiery jugs, he was also a virtuoso of sharp practices, and to this day his feats in that department survive in fable. Nor is there any perceptible improvement in his successors. When a gang of real estate agents, i.e. rent sweaters, bond salesmen, and automobile dealers get together to sob for service, it takes no Freudian to surmise that someone is about to be swindled. The cult of service, indeed, is half a sop to conscience and half a bait to catch conies. Its cultivation in the United States runs parallel with the most gorgeous development of imposture as a fine art that Christendom has ever seen. I speak of a fine art in the literal sense. In the form of advertising, it enlists such talents as, under less pious civilizations, would be devoted to the confection of cathedrals, and even perhaps masses. A sixth of the Americano's income is rooked out of him by rogues who have at him officially and in the name of the government. Half the remainder goes to sharpers who prefer the greater risks and greater profits of private enterprise. All schemes to save him from such victimizations have failed in the past, and all of them, I believe, are bound to fail in the future. Most of the more gaudy of them are simply devices to facilitate fresh victimizations. For democratic man, dreaming eternally of utopias, is ever a prey to shibboleths, and those that fetch him in his political capacity are more than matched by those that fetch him in his role of private citizen. His normal and natural situation, held through all the vicissitudes of his brief history, has been that of one who, at great cost and effort, has sneaked home a jug of contraband whiskey, sworn to have issued out of a padlocked distillery, and then finds, on uncorking it, that it is a compound of pepper, prune juice, and wood alcohol. This, in a sentence, is the history of democracy. It is in detail the history of all such characteristically democratic masterpieces as Bryanism, Ku Kluxery, and the War to End War. They are full of virtuous pretenses, and they are unmitigated swindles. All observers of democracy, from Tocqueville to the Adams brothers and Wilfred Scawen Blunt, have marveled at its corruptions on the political side and speculated heavily as to the causes thereof. The fact was noted in the earliest days of the democratic movement, and Friedrich von Gentz, who began life as an Anglomaniac, was using it as an argument against the parliamentary system as early as 1809. Gentz, who served Metternich, as the current Washington correspondents serve whatever dullards happen to be president, contended that the introduction of democracy on the continent would bring in a reign of bribery, and thus destroy the integrity and authority of the state. The proofs that he was right were already piling up in his day in the United States. They were destined to be greatly reinforced when the Third Republic got underway in France in 1870, and to be given impressive support when the German Republic set up shop in 1918. In 1919, for the first time since the coronation of Henry the Fowler, a German cabinet minister crossed the border between days, his lute under his arm. The historians, immersed in their closets, marvel that such things happen, and marvel even more that democracy takes them calmly, and even lightly. Somewhere in The Education of Henry Adams, you will find an account of the gigantic peculations that went on during the second Grant administration, and melancholy reflections upon the populace's philosophic acceptance of them as inevitable and even natural. In our own time, we have seen the English mob embrace and elevate to higher office the democratic statesmen caught in the Marconi scandal. And the American mob condone almost automatically the Herculean raids upon the Treasury that mark the Wilson administration, and the less spectacular but even more deliberate thievings that went on under the martyred Harding. In the latter case, it turned upon the small body of specialists in rectitude who ventured to protest, and in the end they found themselves far more unpopular than the thieves. Such phenomena, as I say, puzzle the more academic pathologists of democracy. But as for me, I only say that they seem to be in strict accord with God's invariable laws. Why should democracy rise against bribery? It is itself a form of wholesale bribery. In place of a government with a fixed purpose and a visible goal, it sets up a government that is a mere function of the mob's vagaries, and that maintains itself by constantly bargaining with those vagaries. Its security depends wholly upon providing satisfactory bribes for the prehensile minorities that constitute the mob, or that have managed to deceive and inflame the mob. One day the labor leaders, a government within the general government, must be bought with offices. The next day, the dupes of these labor leaders must be bought with legislation, usually of a sort loading the ordinary scales of justice in their favor. The day after, there must be something for the manufacturers, for the Methodists, for the Catholics, for the farmers. I have exhibited in another work the fact that this last class demands bribes pure and simple, and that its yearnings for its own private advantage are never ameliorated by yearnings for the common good. The whole process of government under democracy, as everyone knows, is a process of similar trading. The very head of the state, having no title to his office save that which lies in the popular will, is forced to haggle and bargain like the lowliest office seeker. There has been no president of the United States since Washington who did not go into office with a long list of promises in his pocket, and 9/10 of them have always been promises of private reward from the public store. It is surely not regarded as immoral by the democratic ethic to make and execute such promises, though statesmen of lofty pretensions, e.g. Lincoln, sometimes deny having made them. What is reproached as immoral is making them and then not keeping them. When the late Dr. Wilson made William Jennings Bryan his Secretary of State, the act brought forth only tolerant smiles, though it was comparable to appointing a chiropractor Surgeon General of the Army, a feat which Dr. Harding, a few years later, escaped performing only by a hair. But if Wilson had forgotten his obligation to Bryan, there would have been an outburst of moral indignation, even among Bryan's enemies, and the collapse of Wilson would have come long before it did. When he blew up at last, it was not because, after promulgating his 14 points, he joined in swindling a helpless foe at Versailles. It was because he tried, at Paris, to undo some of the consequences of that fraud by forcing the United States into the League of Nations. A democratic state, indeed, is so firmly grounded upon cheats and humbugs of all sorts that they inevitably color its dealings with other nations, and so one always finds it regarded as a dubious friend and a tricky foe. That the United States, in its foreign relations, has descended to gross deceits and tergiversations since the earliest days of the Republic was long ago pointed out by Lecky. It is regarded universally today as a pious fraud, which is to say, as a Puritan. Nor has England, the next most eminent democratic state, got the name of Perfidy Albion for nothing. Ruled by shady men, a nation itself becomes shady. In its domestic relations, of course, the same causes have the same effects. The government deals with the citizens from whom it has its mandate in a base and disingenuous manner, and fails completely to maintain equal justice among them. It not only follows the majority in persecuting those who happen to be unpopular, it also institutes persecutions of its own, and frequently against men of the greatest rectitude and largest public usefulness. I marvel that no candidate for the doctorate has ever written a realistic history of the American Department of Justice, ironically so called. It has been engaged in sharp practices since the earliest days, and remains a fecund source of oppression and corruption today. It is hard to recall an administration in which it was not the center of grave scandal. Within our own time, it has actually resorted to perjury in its efforts to undo men guilty of flouting it, and at all times it has labored valiantly to nullify the guarantees of the Bill of Rights. The doings of its corps of spies and agents provocateurs are worthy the pen of some confectioner of dime novels. At one time they were employed against the members of the two houses of Congress, and the alarmed legislators threw them off only by threatening to hold up their pay. As Mill long ago pointed out, the tyranny of the majority under democracy is not only shown in oppressive laws, but also in a usurped power to suspend the operation of laws that are just. In this enterprise, a democratic government always marches ahead of the majority. Even more than the most absolute Oriental despotism, it becomes a government of men, not of laws. Its favorites are, to all intents and purposes, immune to criminal processes, whatever their offenses, and its enemies are exposed to espionage and persecution of the most aggravated sort. It takes advantage of every passing craze and delusion of the mob to dispose of those who oppose it. And it maintains a complex and highly effective machine for launching such crazes and delusions when the supply of them lags. Above all, it always shows that characteristically Puritan habit of which Brooks Adams wrote in The Emancipation of Massachusetts, the habit, to wit, of inflicting as much mental suffering as possible upon its victims. That is to say, it not only has at them by legal means, it also defames them, and so seeks to ruin them doubly. The constant and central aim of every democratic government is to silence criticism of itself. It begins to weaken, i.e., the jobs of its component rogues begin to be insecure, the instant such criticism rises. It is thus fidei defensor before it is anything else, and its whole power, legal and extra-legal, is thrown against the skeptic who challenges its infallibility. Constitutional checks have little effect upon its operations, for the only machinery for putting them into effect is under its control. No ruler, indeed, ever wants to be a constitutional ruler, and least of all the ruler whose reign has a term, and who must make hay, in consequence, while the sun shines. Under republics, as under constitutional monarchies, the history of government is a history of successive usurpations. I avoid the banality of pointing to the cases of Lincoln and Wilson. No man would want to be President of the United States in strict accordance with the Constitution. There's no sense of power in merely executing laws. It comes from evading or augmenting them. I incline to think that this view of government as a group of men struggling for power and profit in the face and at the expense of the generality of men has its place somewhere in the dark recesses of the popular mind, and that it accounts, at least in large part, for the toleration with which public corruption is regarded in democratic states. Democratic man, to begin with, is corrupt himself. He will take whatever he can safely get, law or no law. He assumes, naturally and accurately, that the knaves and mountebanks who govern him are of the same kidney. In his own phrase, that they are in public life for what there is in it. It thus does not shock him to find them running true to the ordinances of their nature. If, indeed, an individual among them shows an unusual rectitude and refuses spectacularly to take what might be his for the grabbing, Homo Bubiens sets him down as either a liar or an idiot, and refuses to admire him. So with private rogues who tap the communal till. Democratic man is stupid, but he is not so stupid that he does not see the government as a group of men devoted to his exploitation, that is, as a group external to his own group, and with antagonistic interests. He believes that its central aim is to squeeze as much out of him as he can be forced to yield, and so he sees no immorality in attempting a contrary squeeze when the opportunity offers. Beating the government thus becomes a transaction devoid of moral turpitude. If, when it is achieved on an heroic scale by scoundrels of high tone, a storm of public indignation follows, the springs of that indignation are to be found not in virtue, but in envy. In point of fact, it seldom follows. As I have said, there was little, if any, public fury over the colossal stealings that went on during the Wilson administration, and there was still less over the smaller, but perhaps even more cynical stealings that glorified the short reign of Harding. In the latter case, in fact, most of the odium settled upon the specialists in righteousness who laid the thieves by the heels. The soldiers, coming home from the War for Democracy, did not demand that the war profiteers be jailed. They simply demanded that they themselves be paid enough to make up the difference between what they got for fighting for their country and what they might have stolen had they escaped the draft. Their chief indignation was lavished not upon the airship contractors who made off with a billion, but upon their brothers who were paid $10 a day in the shipyards. The feats of the former were beyond their grasp, but those of the latter they could imagine and envy. This fellow feeling for thieves is probably what makes capitalism so secure in democratic societies. Under absolutism, it is always in danger, and not infrequently, as history teaches, it is exploited and undone, but under democracy it is safe. Democratic man can understand the aims and aspirations of capitalism. They are greatly magnified, simply his own aims and aspirations. Thus he tends to be friendly to it, and to view with suspicion those who propose to overthrow it. The new system, whatever its nature, would force him to invent a whole new outfit of dreams, and that is always a difficult and unpleasant business, to workers in the ditch as to philosophers in the learned grove. Capitalism under democracy has a further advantage. Its enemies, even when it is attacked, are scattered and weak, and it is usually easily able to array one half of them against the other half, and thus dispose of both. That is precisely what happened in the United States after the late war. The danger that confronted capitalism was then a double one. On the one side, there was the tall talk that the returning conscripts, once they got out of uniform, would demand the punishment of the patriots who had looted the public treasury while they were away. On the other side, there was an uneasy rumor that a war katzenjammer was heavily upon them, and that they would demand a scientific inquiry into the true causes and aims of the war, and into the manner and purposes of their own uncomfortable exploitation. This double danger was quickly met and turned off, and by the simple device of diverting the bile of the conscripts against theirs of their own class, who had escaped servitude, to wit, the small group of draft dodgers and conscientious objectors, and the larger group of political radicals, who were represented to be slackers in theory, if not in fact. Thus one group of victims was set upon the other, and the fact that both had a grievance against their joint exploiters was concealed and forgotten. Mob fears, easily aroused, aided in the achievement of the coup. Within a few weeks, gallant bands of American legionaries were hunting Reds down all the back alleys of the land, and godly butchering them when found at odds of 100 to 1. I know of nothing more indicative of the strength of capitalism under democracy than this melodramatic and extremely amusing business. The scheme succeeded admirably, and it deserved to succeed, for it was managed with a laudable virtuosity, and it was based upon a shrewd understanding of democratic psychology. I believe that every other emergency that is likely to arise, at least in the United States, will be dealt with in the same adroit and effective manner. The same thing has been done in other democratic states. I point to the so-called general strike in England in 1926, which was wrecked by pitting half of the proletariat against the other half. The capitalistic system now enlists the best brains in all the democratic nations, including France and Germany. And I believe that, instead of losing such support hereafter, it will get more and more of it. As the old aristocracies decline, the plutocracy is bound to inherit their hegemony and to have the support of the nether mob. An aristocratic society may hold that a soldier or a man of learning is superior to a rich manufacturer or banker, but in a democratic society the latter are inevitably put higher, if only because their achievement is more readily comprehended by the inferior man, and he can more easily imagine himself, by some favor of God, duplicating it. Thus the imponderable but powerful force of public opinion directs the aspirations of all the most alert and ambitious young men toward business. And what is so assiduously practiced tends to produce experts. E.W. Howe, I incline to think, is quite right when he argues that the average American banker or businessman, whatever his demerits otherwise, is at least more competent professionally than the average American statesman, musician, painter, author, labor leader, scholar, theologian, or politician. Think of the best American poet of our time, or the best soldier, or the best violoncellist, and then ask yourself if his rank among his fellows in the world is seriously to be compared with that of the late J. Pierpont Morgan among financial manipulators, or that of John D. Rockefeller among traders. The capitalists, in fact, run the country, as they run all democracies. They emerged in Germany after the Republic arose from the ruins of the late war, like anodyne from the sea. They organize and control the minorities that struggle eternally for power, and so get a gradually firmer grip upon the government. One by one they dispose of such demagogues as Bryan and Roosevelt, and put the helm of state into the hands of trusted and reliable men, McKinley, Harding, Coolidge. In England, Germany, and France, they patronize, in a somewhat wistful way, what remains of the old aristocracies. In the United States, through such agents as the late Gompers, they keep demos penned in a gilt and glittering cage. Public opinion? Walter Lippmann, searching for it, could not find it. A century before him, Fichte said, "Es gar nicht existierte." Public opinion, in its raw state, gushes out in the immemorial form of the mob's fears. It is piped to central factories, and there it is flavored and colored and put into cans. End of section 22.